but just because, at one time or another, a priest or a monk told them they have a soul doesn't mean they have personally experienced their own soul, or know how to get to it and bring its power, beauty, happiness and enlightenment into daily life. Human beings are soul-sick because they are cut off from the ecstasy of creation. Enlightenment, which is the pure experience of the soul's light, is not simply an intellectual understanding one gains about living, it is a direct and powerful entrance into, and experience of, the most ancient, knowledgeable and eternal part of ourselves. We are luminous beings. Master Fuap exclaimed. Beneath our transient physical bodies, we are made of intelligent light. One's own body of light, which I refer to as the soul, is the most real part of oneself because it lives forever. It doesn't die and decay along with the physical body after death. At the end of each of our lifetimes, it transmigrates, through the process of reincarnation, into a new body that is just in the process of being born. Then the soul begins the cycle of living all over again in a new incarnation. Beyond this world, the world we experience each day with our minds and our senses, he continued, are countless other worlds and dimensions. In deep meditation, when your thoughts have become silent, and your emotions are calm and at peace, you can travel into and experience the inner worlds and dimensions of light and perfection, and even experience nirvana itself. There is no experience in this or any other world, whether it is in a physical or astral dimension, that can compare to the experience of enlightenment and nirvana. It is the highest ecstasy. There is nothing more. Master Fuap became silent. Talking about enlightenment and nirvana seemed to have transported him to another plane. Walking next to him, I had the peculiar feeling that he was not entirely in his body. He seemed to have gone far away, to a very private place that I couldn't quite see or reach. Even when people manage, through luck, or through effort, to attain everything in life that they desire, their happiness is usually shallow and short-lived. Most successful people are surprised to find out that the attainment of their goals doesn't necessarily bring them the happiness and joy they assumed would accompany their successes. And even the lucky ones, who do manage to become happy by attaining their goals, live each day with the constant fear of losing whatever it is they may have gained. Even the rich aren't often happy. Their wealth is at best only a temporary distraction. It doesn't make them immune to emotional and mental suffering, or to disease and death. They too must deal with loneliness, the deaths of loved ones and the frustrations and boredom of old age. The rich may have more material goods and benefits than the poor, but most often they tend to lead spiritually impoverished lives. Time holds the final claim check for everything we gain or attain in this lifetime, Master Fuap stated emphatically. All of our possessions, along with the people and feelings we love, are at best only loaned to us for a very short time by eternity. If you live for a very long while, you will have to watch your friends and loved ones die, your body age and lose its beauty and vigor, and your mental capacities fade. All of your physical accomplishments, no matter how important and significant they might have seemed to you at one time, will be relegated to the past. At the end of your life, you will probably end up in an old age home, or in a back room in one of your children's houses, left only with a handful of fading memories and a body racked with great pain and suffering. Unless you have gained the happiness and ecstasy that comes from the practice of meditation, the inevitable destruction of everything that you have loved and worked for will cause you to be very sad and lonely during the final days of your life here on this earth. But Master Fuap, how can enlightenment change any of that? I asked. Just because you are enlightened doesn't mean you aren't going to die, or that you will be protected from bad experiences in life, does it? Master Fuap smiled at me and laughed. No, he said, enlightenment won't enable you to live forever in your current physical body, nor will it prevent all physical misfortunes from befalling you, although it will certainly help you avoid a great many of them, he replied. Then what good is it? I asked. Enlightenment makes you happy. Master Fuap responded with a broad smile. It is the experience of ecstasy beyond anything you can possibly imagine. Knowledge of the enlightenment cycle, of the ways that the inner dimensions and nirvana work, gives you an entirely new perspective on everything. It lifts you far above the transient sorrows, pains, pleasures and joys that the unenlightened masses experience each and every day of their lives. Master Fuap explains enlightenment. It was getting colder, and so far no cars or trucks had passed us. I zipped up my down parka all the way. After walking down the road for a few more minutes, I broke the silence that had settled in between us. I asked Master Fuap if he could give me a brief definition of enlightenment. He laughed so hard that his whole body shook. Then, to the best of my recollection, this is what he said. Enlightenment is the complete awareness of life, without any mental modifications. It is the experience of everything, every dimensional plane, world and reality. It occurs when your mind merges with Nirvana, with what we Tibetans call the Dharmakaya, the clear light of reality, which is the highest plane of transcendental wisdom and perfect understanding. Beyond this world, and beyond all other worlds, he continued, there is an all-perfect light. It is pure intelligence, ecstasy, peace and enlightenment is the experience of that endless and perfect light. There isn't, however, any way that the experience of enlightenment can be conveyed in words. The closest you can come to knowing what it is like, without being enlightened yourself, of course, is to meditate with an enlightened master. However, Master Fuap continued, while I may not be able to describe to you exactly what enlightenment is like, I can tell you that it is wonderful beyond understanding. The experience of enlightenment frees your mind from painful and limited states of awareness. It is ecstasy, peace and happiness beyond measure. After Master Fuap explained to me why he couldn't describe what enlightenment was like, he resumed his narrative about his search for an enlightened master of his own. He told me that after many years of fruitless traveling and searching, he had inwardly resolved that if he hadn't met his master by the time he was 29, he was going to call off his search, and instead find a nice Tibetan woman to settle down with. But, as fate would have it, on the afternoon of his 29th birthday, on his way into town to look for a date, he at long last met his master. The narration of Master Fuap's meeting with his master was interrupted when some long-haired, blonde, Swedish mountain climbers picked us up and gave us a ride back to Kathmandu in an old army truck. Along the way they talked with Master Fuap about how much they wanted to visit Tibet, whose borders were closed to tourists by the Chinese communists. Master Fuap rode in silence, listening to what they had to say, or meditating, it was hard to tell which, until we pulled up in front of the hostel. Before we parted that day, Master Fuap gave me directions to the temple where he lived. He suggested that I visit him the next day around noon. I didn't know what to say to him. I had come to Nepal to surf the Himalayas, not to spend my time talking about enlightenment with a Buddhist monk. I thanked him very much for his invitation and also for telling me a little bit about his life, and I apologized again for having snowboarded him. But in the back of my mind I knew I wouldn't take him up on his offer to visit him the next day. I hopped out of the truck and thanked the Swedish driver and his friends for giving me a ride back into town. They said they were going to drive Master Fuap back to his temple. Laughing, they told me it would be very bad karma not to. Chapter 4, A Second Unusual Dream. Undoubtedly I would not be telling you this story about my adventures as a young adult in Nepal, if I had not had a second, most unusual dream that night after returning to the hostel. After leaving Master Fuap and the Swedish mountain climbers, I entered the hostel and went in search of something to eat. I was famished from my snowboarding adventure and from my encounter and conversation with Master Fuap. After soup, bread and talk about politics with two French university students who had just arrived from India, I crawled into my sleeping bag, and immediately fell into what was at first a deep and dreamless sleep. Dreamless at first, but then I entered a dream that would change my life forever. In my dream I was wandering lost in a snowstorm. I was alone. I felt that I was in the mountains, but I really couldn't be sure, because the snowstorm I found myself in was so severe that I could barely see a few feet ahead of myself. After walking blindly through the snow for what seemed like forever, I came upon a Buddhist temple. The door was slightly ajar. A soft, yellow light came from somewhere within the temple and spilled out through the partially open door onto the snow-covered ground that lay before me. I walked up to the door, opened it the rest of the way and walked into the temple. Once inside, I found myself standing in a very large hall with stained glass windows and a vaulted ceiling. Looking around, I saw that the hall was lit by hundreds of small, flickering candles arranged in neat rows on iron racks attached to the walls. Directly before me, at the front of the room, stood a large, white, marble altar. Six giant, red candles were arranged symmetrically upon its surface. A large, colorful tapestry with a picture of the Buddha sitting in a meditative posture on it was hanging on the wall above the altar. At the far end of the room, facing the altar, I saw a man sitting in a cross-legged position on the floor. His eyes were closed, and he appeared to be absorbed in deep meditation. I found myself walking over to him. As I approached, he turned his head, opened his eyes and looked up at me. I sensed immediately that I knew him, although I couldn't quite place where or when I had met him. He beckoned me silently, with a motion of his left hand, to come over and sit down next to him, and I did so. We stared at each other for a long time without speaking. I saw that he was an American. He appeared to be in his late 40s, and was dressed in a black business suit with a brightly colored tie. "Listen to me," he said in a deep and commanding tone. "Tomorrow you will go to the temple and visit Master Fuap. Forget about snowboarding for now, you have something much more important to do." I didn't reply, I just kept staring at him, trying to figure out where I had met him before. "You can't possibly remember where you met me before," he said, as if he were reading my thoughts. "So stop trying. This is the first time you have ever run into me. Don't you know who I am?" I shook my head. "Well, I would think it should be obvious to you," he said with a strong laugh. "I'm you. Not yet, of course, but in the future. I'm speaking to you in this dream tonight because you are about to make the biggest mistake in your thus far uneventful life." "What's that?" I asked. "Going snowboarding tomorrow instead of seeing Master Fuap at his temple. You owe him your life, you know. You ran him down with your snowboard on that mountain today. He could easily have burned you into a very small pile of ashes, but because he is compassionate, he let you. You're our master, and to place us on our destined path." "How are we doing?" I asked. "Oh, in the future? Well, it's certainly going to be very different from what you had imagined. This place is my, our, temple. Not bad, is it? We designed it ourselves. Don't worry. Our future will reveal itself to you one day at a time, and that's fast enough. The point I want to make to you tonight is that you must not make a mistake by going snowboarding tomorrow. Go and see Master Fuap instead. Oh, and by the way, he knows a lot more about snowboarding than you ever will." The room turned gold, faded and dissolved, and I awoke to my second morning in Nepal. Chapter 5, I Visit Master Fuap. I spent most of the early morning that day meandering through some of the shops in Kathmandu. The majority of them sold inexpensive religious trinkets to tourists. But as distracted as I was by the sights and sounds of Kathmandu, I couldn't quite get the dream I had of my future self out of my mind. And reluctantly, I decided to heed my future self's advice and seek out Master Fuap after all. Master Fuap's temple was not too hard to find. It was about a half-hour walk outside central Kathmandu. The directions he had given me the day before were excellent, and before I knew it, I was knocking on his temple door. Master Fuap greeted me at the door with a big smile on his face and ushered me into the meditation hall. From there we walked to the rear of the temple, to an area where his living quarters were located. He seemed very happy to see me again. He laughed and made funny sounds and remarks as we walked through the temple together. His mood was infectious, and by the time we had reached the door to his room, I was very happy to be with him again. He opened the door to his room and led me inside. Looking around, I saw that Master Fuop's room was lit by candles, although a little bit of light also filtered in through several small windows up near the ceiling. His room was small and clean. It contained a bed, a writing desk with a small chair, and a meditation table that had several white candles and a small bronze figure of the Buddha on it. On the floor in front of the meditation table was a large akhair carpet, on which he invited me to sit. After exchanging pleasantries with me, Master Fuop picked up his narration from the previous day, continuing his story as if no time at all had passed since we had walked down the snowy road to Kathmandu together. Master Fuop resumed his story, telling me that he had finally encountered his long-sought-after master on the outskirts of a small town in western Tibet. As he was walking toward the town on that fateful day, in search of a date, he observed an older Buddhist monk standing by the side of the road several yards ahead. Just when he was about to walk past, the unknown elderly monk stepped right out in front of Master Fuop and blocked his passage into the town. Master Fuop came to an immediate stop, and out of Buddhist courtesy he waited for the older monk to walk by him. But the unknown monk continued to stand his ground and stared fiercely, directly into his eyes. It was precisely at that moment, while staring into the unknown monk's eyes, that Master Fuop both literally and figuratively saw the light. As he stared at the unknown monk, he suddenly saw thousands of waves of golden light surrounding the monk's entire body. Seeing the waves of golden, auric light emanating from the aged Buddhist monk, Master Fuop intuitively realized that the unknown monk who was blocking his passageway into town was none other than his past life master from his previous incarnations. Instead of going into town and finding a date as he had planned, Master Fuop and his rediscovered past life master went off together to meditate in a nearby cave, and to catch up on old times. Master Fuop's master, whose name was Fuas Shastradup, revealed to him that day the secret mystical teachings and techniques of the Ray Quartz Fuas, information, Master Fuop told me, he in turn was going to reveal to me. Master Fuop said that because of my karma from previous lifetimes he was going to initiate me into the innermost, secret, tantric teachings of the Ray Quartz Fuas Buddhist order, just as he had been initiated and been taught those same secrets and techniques by his own master, Fuas Shastradup, in a Himalayan cave on that fateful day of their multi-life reunion. It was all karma, he said. Chapter 6, Master Fuop explains karma. At that point I was somewhat dazed and confused by Master Fuop's sudden revelation that because of my past life karma, he was going to initiate me into the secret tantric Buddhist teachings of the Ray Quartz Fuas. I stalled Master Fuop trying to decide whether or not I wanted to get involved with his tantric Buddhist revelations. To buy myself a little time, I asked Master Fuop if he would explain what karma was. I told him that, while I had heard the word used as slang hundreds of times before in California, I really had no idea what the word karma meant to a tantric Buddhist master. Until my conversation with Master Fuop that day, it had been my understanding that karma meant what you have coming to you, because of what you have done in your past. I asked Master Fuop if he would elaborate on the meaning of the word, because I was sure that my understanding of karma was probably both superficial and incorrect. Master Fuop smiled at me for a moment and said nothing. I assumed he was collecting his thoughts on the subject before speaking. Then, in a deep and dramatic tone, he informed me that I already knew the answer to my own question. He said all I had to do was to recollect it. Master Fuop went on to explain that I had known all about karma, and many other mystical things, in my past lives. He said that all the knowledge from my previous incarnations was contained in what he referred to as my other memory. Master Fuop told me that if I would simply stop all my thoughts for just a few minutes and clear my mind of distracting influences, my other memory would start functioning, and I would be able to answer my own question about karma. I quickly replied that I didn't think I could stop my thoughts for even a few seconds at a time, let alone for a few minutes, and that I would very much appreciate it if he would serve as my other memory for the time being. He laughed and said he would do it for me this time, but eventually I would have to learn to retrieve things from my other memory on my own. Karma is the way that Buddhists explain the universe, Master Fu began. Buddhists understand that today, and all other days, have turned out the way they have because of karma. The past leads to the present moment, and the present moment leads to the future. The interconnection of one moment with another moment, and of one action with another action, is karma. Karma is what happens to you today, Master Fu continued. It is simply the law of cause and effect in action. What occurs to you today is an outgrowth of what happened yesterday. All moments and occurrences are caused by other moments and occurrences that preceded them, in an endless, causal chain of karmic interactions that lead back indefinitely through time. But Master Fu, I interjected, there had to be a beginning to karma at some point. Wasn't there a first moment somewhere in karmic time? No. He smiled, karma has always existed, as have you, I, and all things in this wonderful universe. Master Fu, this is deep. Let me see if I correctly understand what you are saying. I exist today the way I do, and the world exists today the way it does, because of yesterday's karma, and yesterday existed the way it did, because of the day before yesterday's karma, and the day before yesterday existed the way it did, because of the preceding day's karma. Exactly. He said, nodding his neatly shaved bald head in affirmation. So does that mean that everything is fated, Master Fu? If what occurs in this moment sets up the next moment, and so on forever, then there is really no such thing as free will, is there? I asked. A complicated question from one who is so young, he replied. I will do my best to answer it for you. You see, karma is fate, it is true. If you throw a rock up into the air, it will come down and land someplace. You might say that the place that the rock lands is its karma. But then again, it was your free choice whether or not to throw the rock up into the air in the first place. Everything that exists in this or any other world or dimension, he continued, does so because of the way that things were in the previous moment. I call this the karma of the moment. But with free will, we can modify, to a certain extent, the chain of karma that has been set in motion by the karma of the previous moment. That is what free will really is. It is the ability to alter the sequence of karmic fate that was about to become our future. So, Master Fu, I responded, if I understand you correctly, you believe that we are the way we are because of how we were a moment ago. That moment leads to this moment, as this moment will lead to the next moment. I can understand that. But Master Fu, if that's true, then how can free will exist? Isn't the choice to alter your future karma by exercising your free will now predestined by what you were thinking and feeling and by what was happening to you in the previous moment? Master Fu shook his head and laughed. All of this is perhaps a little bit more complicated than it initially appears to be, he replied. Let me try to describe the interaction of karma and free will to you in another way. Let us consider, as a way of trying to understand how karma works, who we are and how we got to be who we are. You see, my young friend, Master Fu continued, karma not only means that what happens to you in the present moment is a direct outgrowth of what occurred to you in the previous moment. It also means that you are who you are right now because of who you were in the previous moment. Buddhists believe that you are who you are today because of who you have been in all of your past lives. It is the tantric Buddhist belief that today you are the product of all the moments you have lived in your current life so far, and of all the moments, realizations and experiences you have had in all your past lives as well. The person you are today, the feelings you have, the thoughts you think and the way you see yourself are all part of your past life and present life karmas. I must have had a puzzled look on my face, because he paused and laughed. Let me use myself as an example. He continued. I have always been interested in Buddhism, astrology, psychic perception and enlightenment. I was born this way. My brothers and sisters, who grew up in the same family I did and who were exposed to the same physical and spiritual environments I was, have little or no interest in these inner matters. They are all primarily concerned with physical things that relate to their material success, such as making a living and raising a family. My brothers and sisters and I all had the same biological parents. We were all raised in the same way. But each of us is very different. That is our karma, who we were born as, and also who we grew up to be. Death is not the end of who we are, Master Fuap said in a warm and intimate tone. It is only a brief pause in the endless cycle of our lives. Each of us is a spirit that cannot die. Our spirit grows and develops traits in each incarnation that it passes through, and then collects and carries the essence of those traits into future lifetimes. In Buddhist yoga we refer to our multi-life karmic traits as samskaras. They are the internal karmic patterns that make each of us who and what we are. We are born into this lifetime as the person that we were at the moment of our death in our last lifetime. Our adult personality is a mirror image of who we were in the last stage of our life in our previous incarnation. I could tell by the smile on Master Fuap's face that he knew I had absolutely no idea what he was talking about. After a brief period of silence, Master Fuap tried yet another approach to enlighten me on the subject of karma. Try thinking of it this way, Master Fuap began. Children go to school in the winter. In the summer they stay at home. When they return to school the next fall, they resume their education in a higher grade because of the schoolwork and the grade they completed the previous year. While it is true that a child may have developed some new ideas or interests during the course of the previous school year, or over the summer, or even may have changed their views on several subjects, the essence of the child's personality will have remained the same. Although the child is now in a new and higher grade, and may now know new things and have had many new and different experiences, the child is still the same child. In much the same way, whatever you have learned in your previous incarnations is retained within your causal body, your multi-lifetime body of energy that lives from one incarnation to another. It is your causal body that is the real you. At the end of each incarnation, it carries the knowledge and karmic patterns of that particular lifetime, in addition to the knowledge and karmic patterns of all of your other previous lifetimes, into your next incarnation. Death is only a summer vacation for us. Master Fuap exclaimed. We don't really change or lose what we have learned or who we have been when we die, because we are our karma. The choices we make and the thoughts we allow ourselves to think, the emotions that we let run through our bodies and minds and the interests we pursue, these are the things that shape and define the spirit. That is what karma is really made of. Master Fuap paused for a moment to examine me. He arched his eyebrows slightly and then looked directly into my eyes. He must have been at least partially satisfied by what he saw there, because he smiled, bowed his head, and then said jokingly, "Buddha's name be praised." Then, after several minutes of silence, he resumed his discussion of karma with me. So, for example, in my case, in my last several dozen lifetimes I was a teacher of Buddhist enlightenment. I was enlightened, and I helped others who were interested in self-discovery to advance along the pathway to enlightenment in each of my enlightened lifetimes. The reason I was enlightened in my last several dozen incarnations was that many, many thousands of incarnations ago, of my own free will, I became interested in self-discovery and in the study of enlightenment. I studied meditation and learned all about the inner worlds and the higher dimensions from great Buddhist masters who knew about these matters. One lifetime led to another. In each lifetime, after first passing through the amnesia of infancy and childhood, the inclinations and memories from my past lives would resurface. Once this happened, I was irresistibly drawn back to the study of meditation and enlightenment. In one particular incarnation, I became enlightened, and I have regained and refined my enlightenment in every incarnation I have had since that time. However, in my current lifetime, on the fateful day of my 29th birthday, when I had just met my past life master, Fuas Shastradup, outside that little town in Tibet, I had absolutely no idea I had ever been enlightened in any of my previous incarnations. Master Fuas Shastradup told me that I had been enlightened in my past lives, Master Fuap continued. He then taught me how to use the secret and powerful meditation techniques of the Ray Quartz Fuas. After practicing the techniques each day for many years, coupled with my master's spiritual guidance and auric empowerments, I was able to bring my past life enlightenment back. Later, because it was also my karma, Master Fuaz made me his successor. This all happened to me in this lifetime because of the things I had learned and the choices I had made in my previous incarnations.